Vaisak is partly a celebration of the Buddha's birth. And as happens in many of the different South Asian traditions, the stories of the Buddha's birth were elaborated and mythologized over the centuries. In the earliest layer of texts, in the Pali Canon, the stories are very simple and not supernatural. But even within a few hundred years, there start to be layers of myth that begin to arise, where, for instance, the Buddha's mother has a dream in which a white elephant appears, and this is interpreted as the sign that she's going to give birth to a really important being. And she carries the Buddha for 10 months, so a bit long for mothers in the room. You're like, oh, yeah. But, you know, he's the Buddha, so he gets born painlessly. She's walking in the gardens of the palace. They're wealthy. The Buddha's family is the governing family, one of the governing families of the tribe of the Sakyans in an area known as Magadha in northern what's now India or southern what's now Nepal. The area at the time is comprised of a sort of patchwork of essentially city-states or small republics. And so the Buddha's family was an important family in one of those. So the Buddha's mother is walking in the pleasure garden when it comes time to give birth. And the story says that she just reached up and held onto a branch, and the Buddha was born like that. So, and then as the myth developed, one of the images that came out was that the Buddha was born, and immediately two streams of water poured down from the sky, one warm and one cool, to wash the baby off, baby and mother off. And then in one version of the story, the baby immediately stands up and takes seven steps, and under his feet, lotus flowers appear to cushion him. And at the end of seven steps, he holds up a hand and says, "I am the world honored one, the greatest." So this is beautiful. My child was not born quite so smoothly, you know, nor dramatically, but there's something there about birth and the appearing of someone, and the sense that this being, you know, appears with a kind of clarity already present. Part of the mythology of the Buddha is that the person we think of as the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama of the Sakyan clan, somewhere around fourth or fifth century before the Common Era, that this being was actually the final birth, you know, in an endlessly long series of births, of course, where the Buddha describes himself as a bodhisattva, a bodhisattva, and that when he eventually attains liberation, finds the deathless, in his words, he says, "Done is what had to be done. This is my last birth. There is no more coming to any state of being." And there's this sense that what happens when one becomes fully awake, the word Buddha means awake. When one becomes a Buddha, when one awakens, the chain of rebirth is broken. And it's broken because it was maintained through the process of grasping. And this is a way of saying that the Buddhist interpretation of karma, or the flow of action and its results, is that actions undertaken with a certain intention bear fruit, or unfold through time in a way that reflects that original intention. So like, you know, I try to do something in my life, but the intention is to succeed, let's say. And I'm purposefully choosing something that's neither obviously wholesome or obviously unwholesome. Like, it could be wholesome to want to succeed. It could be unwholesome to want to succeed, depending on what you want to succeed at and why and all that. But there's a karma to it, meaning that there is a force or an impulse behind it that colors all the actions that spin forward from that impulse. And so, you know, I try to succeed, I do certain things, I succeed or fail, you know, in whatever way it unfolds. And this is not a problem unless, like the young Buddha, I'm looking for something else. So what happens to the Buddha is, first of all, that when he's born, you know, he's a child of wealth. So they invite some astrologers to come, some sages to come and check out the baby. And again, I'm again speaking from the sort of mythical layer of his story that shows up a little bit after the earliest texts. The astrologers come and they check out the baby and they say, oh, this kid is going to be awesome, really, really amazing. He bears all of the marks of a great being, including, and again, this is a mythical list, a point on the top of his head, extremely long earlobes, hands that hang down to his knees when he's standing up, a kind of goldenish skin tone, the mark of wheels on the bottoms of his feet, the mark of wheels on the bottom of his feet, a tongue that can touch his forehead and both ears. There's a series of these marks. And so the sages say, this child has all these marks of a great being. He will either be a powerful king, a wheel-turning monarch, an amazing king, or an amazing spiritual teacher, a religious leader, who will bring many people to liberation. And it's a good prophecy to have for your kid. And the Buddha's father, the story says, recognized something in this prophecy, which is that, first of all, he had an agenda. The dad, who was a ruler, right? He said, well, I prefer the king version to the spiritual teacher version, right? You're like, would you like your kid to be, you know, to become a great leader, you know, and rich and powerful, or would you like him to be, you know, essentially a kind of impoverished cult figure living in the forest? Which is what happened. The father has this insight that turns out to be correct, right? Which is that contact with suffering, contact with the reality of old age, sickness, and death, with pain, is what turns people toward religion, toward spirit, toward the search for liberation. And so then the father, mythically, again, decides to shield the boy from suffering. So this is a story about privilege, actually, right? And being sheltered. So young Gotama grows up, it's said, in a walled garden where there are three palaces, one constructed for each of the three seasons so that they stay comfortable through the whole year. And everything in it is beautiful. All of the servants and his friends and the people around are all young and beautiful. And whenever any sign of decay would show up, the flowers would wilt, the musicians, all the musicians are women at this time in Indian history, so the musician women, they get sick for a while or they age. They're just transferred to a different part of the estate and fresh young ones are brought in their place. This now starts to be, right, switch into mythical mind and not sort of literal mind here, but we're really thinking about, like, what would it be like to try to shelter someone from any contact with suffering and loss? And again, to make this a story about parenting, everything is a story about parenting for me right now with the toddler. I was watching my child do something last week or sometime, and I think we were talking about something that had happened in his playgroup, and there was a sort of there's some social dynamics among the 2 year olds, and we were trying to you know address what to do with the other parents, and I literally had the thought, I won't be able to protect him from suffering. Like he's going to go out in the world and people are going to be mean and ignorant and whatever. He's going to get hurt. And, you know, and all of y'all who are older parents than me, you're like, duh. But, you know, I actually had the thought, like, oh my God, I can't protect him from that. And it's heart-wrenching. Like, wait, no, we're not going to school. We're not actually, you know, going to hang out with anybody who isn't being similarly parented in a hyper-extreme Bay Area perfectionist sort of way. And then I'm like, oh no, we're just going to raise a hyper-extreme neurotic Bay Area child. Like, I know those kids. And it's not pretty either way. And it turns out that you can't protect someone from suffering. So this parable is partly about what happens when you try. And I have a warm heart toward the Buddha's dad. You know, him being like, we're going to try, you know, and money is no obstacle. So at some point in his late teens, they marry him off to a good partner from another good family. So he has a wife, and they eventually have a child by the time he's in his mid-20s. And what is it that turns him? The texts just say that he wanted to know what was out there in the world. And he asks his chariot driver to take him out past the walls. And they do so. But when I think about it, I think about, like, okay, here's this kid. He's been living in, again, mythically speaking, sort of absurd luxury. And what is it? You know, is it just like wanderlust? Like he kind of just sees something on the other side of the wall? He just gets curious? Or you could go with the, you know, with the sort of like divine purpose direction and say, like, no, you can't actually derail a prophecy like that. Like, it's going there. And something had to turn in his heart. So I'll tell you two different versions of the story. In the Theravada version, more my home base, the story unfolds that the Buddha gets curious, asks his driver to take him out into the town, out into the city. He does so. And on 4 successive trips out, he sees people out in the town. And the first person he sees is a sick person, someone who's, and the text describes it in quite graphic detail, but someone who's really suffering, really sick. And the Buddha says to his driver, like, what's that? And you know, he's never seen a sick person before. The driver says, this is a sickness. And here's the question that is the question to ask yourself. You know the answer, but do you really believe the answer is the question, right? The Buddha says, young Gotama says, could that happen to me? And the driver says, yes. In fact, it must. Like, it always does, eventually. Young Gotama, whoa, take me home. But the next day, and the texts elaborate, like, he couldn't sleep that night. You know, the next day, take me out again. They go out. And then they see an old person. And the text again is quite graphic. You know, an old person bent nearly double over, their spine crooked like a roof beam, hair fallen out, teeth fallen out, skin blotched and sagging, supporting themselves on a stick, etc. Could that happen to me? Yes, you know, it must. You know, again, can't sleep. Third trip out, they see as you would see in that in those times, and it's harder to see now, unless you go looking. But he sees a corpse being carried to the cremation grounds. What's that? You know, and this is the crux of the whole thing, right? That's death. That's a dead person. Could that happen to me? My Lord, it happens to everyone. It will happen to you. It must. This is the, you know, this is the sand that made the oyster. This is the pearl. This is the thing that blew up his privileged, comfortable life. And I think nowadays about how we use the word privilege in relation to, like, you know, folks who are deluded in relation to, like, class or race or a condition that can happen for those who are on the oppressor side of an oppressor oppressed dynamic, or folks who are unaware that the comforts that they experience are the product of conditions, not the norm or the way things should be. They're actually an anomaly in a certain way, statistically, often quite an anomaly. So the Buddha is shocked at this contact with death. And he asks to go out a fourth time. And on the fourth trip out from the walled garden, they see a different kind of person. He's seen all these people in the town going about their business, doing all their stuff. On the fourth trip out, he sees somebody dressed in robes, walking slowly and mindfully, carefully along, holding the alms bowl. And the text really emphasizes that Gautama sees that this person's face was calm, that their movement was controlled, that they radiated something, they shone with a different kind of presence. And Gautama says, what's that? Who's that? What are they doing? And his driver, whose name is Channa, says, oh, that's a mendicant, a homeless one, a wanderer. Different terms for that would arise. Bhikkhu, meaning homeless one, sannyasi, one who has left the home life. Muni, sage, silent one. This is someone who has left the home life and is seeking the deathless, is seeking liberation. And the Buddha instantly says, you know, like, that's what I have to do. And there's a different story that gets emphasized in the Chinese versions that has him actually, this is a little bit more dramatic and a little bit more puritanical version of the story, but there's a version of him, again, realizing dissatisfaction with his privileged life by waking up in the morning after what the texts really paint as essentially kind of a wild party. And it says, like, he had been partying late at night with people, and he looks around and he sees all of his friends, like beautiful young people, and sexy women and musicians and all asleep, and they're with like drooling and kind of disheveled and all of the sparkle from the party gone, and he sees this kind of like, oh, this is what's really there. And in both cases, the feeling is a kind of disenchantment. Like, oh, I've been lost in this sort of bubble of perfection. But it was an illusion, not because it wasn't pleasurable, but because I was being denied contact with the full reality of human existence. And so leaving his his wife and infant child in the care of the extended family, a gesture for which he has been appropriately criticized by modern feminists. He goes off into the forest and cuts off his long royal hair, trades clothes with his driver, so his first gesture is a gesture of class switching, sort of. And he goes off to practice. He practices for 6 years, during which time he learns the yogic practices of the day, which were essentially extreme meditative concentration and then ascetic practice, tormenting the body. He starves himself almost to death practicing. And as I said in our meditation, the insight that turns him toward realization is this insight about how to practice. And the insight is that tormenting the body doesn't work, in the same way that indulgence in pleasure that he grew up in doesn't work. And so comparing those two, he says, I've discovered the middle way. The middle way that is neither sensual indulgence nor bodily mortification. And the idea of bodily mortification at the time was that if the thing we're trying to end is the process of karma that plays out through wanting or grasping or desiring, then one of the ways to do that might be to cause the body tremendous pain and, in a sense, burn up action in this kind of ascetic fire. A lot of power comes when you learn to tolerate intense experience. The Buddha's insight was that that path didn't actually lead to the liberation that he sought. And he finds a middle path by remembering that as a child, he had spontaneously dropped into a very easeful, pleasurable meditative state one day during a harvest festival, a plowing festival, a spring festival, outside, sitting under a rose apple tree. And that state was characterized by pleasure, by ease, by a very simple but steady, embodied concentration. He has the insight that this is the way. He has to nourish his body in order to practice that way, so he begins to accept the offerings of food. And mythically, he takes one offering of food from a woman named Sujata, an offering of milk rice. And again, in one of the myths, after he eats this rich, nourishing food, nourishing his body, he says, if I have indeed, you know, discovered the path to the deathless, you know, give me a sign, basically. And he throws the bowl in the river, and the bowl floats upstream rather than down. And he says, oh, this is the path that goes against the stream of ordinary life that is colored by grasping and delusion and hatred all the time. We go against that stream. And he sits down under a tree near the banks of a river in what's now Bihar state. And it says he makes a cushion of kusa grass, soft grass that sages would sit on, and he vows to not get up until he realizes the end of the path. And in the course of one night, he finds that end. Having found the deathless, he then teaches for the next 45 years, walking back and forth all over northeast India, the banks of the Ganga. He interacts with the kings and the royalty of the day. He tries to stop a war and fails. He establishes the community of monastics, and that spreads out at different times to be the dominant religious force in the entire subcontinent. Within a few centuries, an emperor has converted to Buddhism and converted the entire nation. And some centuries after that, Buddhism reaches deep up into Central Asia through the Gandharan kingdom, all the way up to what we now call Mongolia. Mongolia is essentially Tibetan Buddhist. So as Buddhism becomes established, it spreads, it spreads, it gets preserved in its earliest forms in Sri Lanka, Burma, and Thailand, as the waves of religious change move and break and pass in India itself. And this tradition the Buddha began consists of these teachings that he put forward, but also of the institution of the monastic sangha, the community of monks and nuns, along with the Jains, who were founded at about the same time. The Buddha and the Jains were the first organizations to ordain women as monastics. So men and women monastics practicing under a beautifully organized set of guidelines that then sustained for millennia through all sorts of political change. And the momentum that the Buddha set in motion through both the force of his own liberation and the act of teaching is said to be the wheel of the Dharma rolling forward. So the Buddha awakens fully. In other talks, I've described sort of that process in more detail. I won't do it right now. He awakens fully with the morning star and then hangs out for several weeks near the tree. In Bodh Gaya, the shrine to this, the Bodhi tree itself, and there's a temple there, there's all these little spots around the tree where it says, like, in the seventh week after the enlightenment, the Buddha hung out here contemplating the beauty of dependent origination. And then, like, you know, 30 feet around a corner, it's like, you know, in the fourth week after the enlightenment, the Buddha hung out here for a week, you know, contemplating the truth of karma. You know, that's like, he just sort of hung out, blissing on liberation. And it's said that it occurred to him that the liberation that he had found was so subtle, so not obvious, that no one would understand him. And he considered not teaching. Who would get it? And it's said that Sakya, the king of the gods, which is the Buddhist version of Indra, the ancient king of the gods in the Vedic system, overheard the Buddha thinking this, because the gods are listening to what you think. Same as Santa Claus, really, right? And Sakya, or Indra, appears, comes down from the Brahma heaven and appears in front of the Buddha, who's hanging out, blessing. And Sakya says, "Blessed one, you're wrong. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who would understand this teaching, as subtle as it is." And the Buddha only then uses his supernatural power of vision to look out across the world, and he sees, indeed, there are beings who would understand. And then he decides to teach. The first people he wants to teach are his previous yoga teachers who taught him concentration, but they've both died suddenly, recently. And so then he goes to find his friends that he had been practicing with. He goes to his sangha. They had left when he took that bowl of rice because they were like, "Ah, he's gone soft. He broke his fast. We're out of here." So he walks 100 miles or so to Benares, Varanasi. And just outside Varanasi in Sarnath, in the deer park, his friends are gathering. They're doing their ascetic practice. He walks up to them. He looks really different than he did before. They're like, "Whoa." He gives them this teaching. He teaches the middle way, he teaches the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path to the end of suffering. And in the course of his teaching that, one of the five gets it. And the text says his Dharma eye was opened. And he exclaims at the end of the text, "Everything that arises passes away." That is the exclamation of having entered the path. That's the thing you get when you get it. Everything that arises passes away. And his name was Kondanya. And the Buddha says, "Kondanya gets it. Kondanya gets it." And that was the beginning. And the text, this is the first discourse of the Buddha called Turning the Wheel of the Dhamma, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. The text ends by saying, in the deer park at Sarnath, the Blessed One turns the wheel of the Dhamma that cannot be stopped by human, Brahma, Mara, or anyone in the cosmos. And that turning is the passing of the teaching, the passing of clear vision from the realized one to his student. That is the turning of the wheel. And as long as folks in every single generation without a break practice and a few realize that liberation, then the wheel keeps turning. And as soon as a generation goes by where no one does that, it stops. So, practice. Cool. So, happy Vaisak. Really a pleasure to celebrate the Buddha with you. Some time for questions, thoughts, reflections here.
When the Buddha says, give me a sign, and throws the rice ball, is he asking Sakka, the universe? Does he have he's been raised to do Hindu puja, to...
It's a good question, right? Because Buddhism is thought of as being essentially atheistic.
Right.
But that's a Western term that talks about, you know, a philosophy that resists the idea of a singular, all-powerful Judeo-Christian deity. But there's gods all over the Buddhist texts. You know, Sakka shows up all the time. And actually, the stories of the Buddha's incarnations actually say that the Buddha himself was Sakka, the king of the gods, several different times. As many of us may have been, or we all in the most cosmic Mahayana idea. The idea being that the heaven realms are just realms where one could get reborn if you have super awesome karma, as you do, perhaps. You get reborn there. And so then the deities are more like offices rather than identities. So like you could become president, you could become Sakka, the king of the gods, you know. You could become... And there are texts that are very interesting where the Buddha says, you know, one of the responsibilities of householders is actually to maintain the proper observances toward, you know, the deities of your family. The shift simply is that, appears to be that... it's almost like, you know, worshiping the deities had its own purpose, right? To generate good fortune, to keep the crops growing, to make the rains fall, to get sons, etc. Those would still be the reasons to propitiate the deities. But if what you want is liberation from the round of birth and death, the deities can't help you because they're on it, right? Sakka, the king of the gods, will eventually die, right? Krishna dies. Lakshmi dies. You know, as the world ends and it all starts over again, you know. And so it's not like the Buddha having a relationship with deities changes the fundamentally non-theistic nature of Buddhist practice, because it was still the case that the Buddha had to turn away from any recourse to anything other than profound letting go in order to get liberated. So I don't recall that in the text like that he asks anyone in particular. And the myth gets elaborated in lots of ways, and I've heard different versions of it. And it may well be that, you know, many of us that tell it elaborate things that aren't exactly in the Lalita Vistara or which the Buddhavamsa, whatever version of the myth we're looking at. But the gesture is in there. The like throws the bowl in the water, it goes upstream, he sees that that is a sign that something is happening. And then the metaphor of goes against the stream comes from that. Yeah. It was very interesting. Like when I've never heard it taught on, but I was reading the discourses and I came upon this discourse that was like, you know, one of the things you should do is like worship the appropriate deities. And I was like, what? That's not what I ever got taught that this religion was about. But taken within the cultural context, it makes sense, right? He wasn't saying those practices are wrong. He was just saying, that's not what I want, you know. And he was part of a whole movement of folks doing that. So, yeah.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
It was very special tonight. I'm not sure if I have a smart question.
Not necessary.
So, all the teaching improves quality of life. I can definitely see, you know, like positive influences in my life by following someone's actions. But, you know, that idea is so mystical.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you've ever met in person liberated people.
It's a good question.
Like, I know it's like kind of mystical. It's still like when you talk about religion, about Buddha's story, it's like, it's hard to imagine, right? It's like a fairy tale.
Yeah.
But, you know, it exists.
Yeah.
So, are there people like that?
Yes.
For real?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The most important thing, I think, to think about in relation to liberation or enlightenment, realization, is that it's not a black and white thing. It's not like, you know, what would be an example? Like, okay, I just got my PhD. And so now you know somebody who has a PhD. Maybe you know lots of them, right? But you might have come from a place where nobody has a PhD, you know, somewhere either where that's just not a thing or where there's not that many people that go to college or whatever. And in a situation like that, you might say, are there really people that have that thing? Like, that seems absurd. But that makes it seem like it's a sort of all or nothing thing. Like, you either have it or you don't, right? But realization is not described that way in the texts. It's more described as a long spectrum of essentially kind of developmental progress. So there's not just a single enlightenment marker, but there's lots of steps. So like when Kondanya sees that everything that arises passes away, he doesn't attain the full liberation of the Buddha. He attains what's called stream entry, which is just that first hit. It's like a little taster of liberation. And he has further work to do. And the texts say it takes him, all five of them get enlightened within a week. So it takes him another couple days to really get it. Don't feel bad. You know, it's different times, different myth. But the thing to really think about with liberation isn't so much like, are there liberated people, but like, what's the spectrum of liberation like? Like, I've met lots of people who are relatively free. And I've met a few people who are really different from everybody else I know in that direction. Whether they are like fully, whatever that means, kind of liberated like a Buddha, there's no way to know. Because that, the extremes of liberation are, like you're saying, mystical. Like, it's pretty impossible to describe. But there's totally people you can go hang out with here in the Bay Area who are pretty substantially different than anything you've encountered before. And they're around.
Totally have PhDs.
You know, some of them have master's degrees. Some of them, you know, some of them have like, you know, just a BFA, but from a really nice art school. You know.
Probably driving a bus on those.
Some of them are, exactly, exactly. Yeah, you know, one of my teachers, Sylvia Borstein, who is quite a liberated being, really, as far as I can tell. You know, she said things. People will ask her, like, are you enlightened? People always ask teachers, are you enlightened? And you know, she'll kind of smile and laugh, and you know, and she'll be like, but at one point we were on retreat, somebody asked her, and she got a little serious, and she was like, okay, we always kind of joke about this answer, but let me try to sort of say it for real. And she said, I really am quite free, you know? Like, not completely, but really quite a bit. Maybe that's as much as I can, like, that's what she could say. She's like, you know, yeah, somewhat, you know. And another of my teachers, Jack, would also get asked that question. And he's more of a joker. People would say, are you enlightened, Jack Kornfield? And he'll always sort of put on his, I would now say slightly problematic, fake Indian accent. And he'll say, yes. But then he'll get serious and say, but you've asked the wrong question. The question isn't, are you enlightened? The question is, how enlightened are you? And the answer, of course, is somewhat, right? It's the same answer. And I talk about this a lot in terms of developmental process, right? If liberation consists in a profound letting go of everything that you hold on to, then a mini liberation must consist in letting go of a mini thing. And so, you know, I think about, like, the things that I was obsessed with when I was 20. I'm not obsessed with them anymore. In fact, there's a whole bunch of things that I was so into, and right now, really, I'm just done with them, right? Like, I don't ever need to watch Doctor Who again. It's good, good show, right? Tom Baker was my doctor, for those listening out in Radio Land who might be counting the doctors. I never watched the new series, so only the old ones. But I was so into it. I had VHS tapes of every single episode from 1963 to 1985. Missed a couple, mostly. And now, I'm just done. Like, I got over it. It was a teenage thing, which is fine, right? There's so many things like that for all of us, right? Are you still fixated on your first love when you were 13? Like, maybe, it's fine, go for it. But, you know, probably not. And so I think of liberation in that way. I was grasping onto something, now I'm not. Therefore, I'm free from that thing. And then the liberation of the Buddha is just the deep version of that. You know, it's like, oh, thinking that I am, you know, myself, or that I, you know, that I am what I think I am, etc. So yeah, liberation starts with easy stuff. As you start to practice, maybe you give up some bad habits. You're enlightened in relation to that, whatever it was. You know, the whole thing can be thought of as a addiction recovery program, basically. Right? Give up your addiction to the surface level things, and bit by bit work your way down until you're, you know, doing recovery work on, like, the deep layers of your identity. And that's when it starts to get really mystical, as you're saying. So yeah, so those folks are around. You'll find them. What the Buddha would say in relation to this question, he said, monks, if it were not possible to fully liberate the heart from greed, hatred, and delusion, I would not ask you to do so. Only because it is possible to fully liberate the heart do I ask you to do so. So, if possible, go for it. Anything else?
Maybe the Buddha would just set in there to its as an aspiration.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and fooling us all and saying, it's possible, it's possible, because the life of aspiring to be fully liberated is in itself a liberation.
It's a good life.
It's a good life. It's a good life. But it's a practice. You have to keep doing it. You have to do it every breath, right? You have to constantly let go.
Absolutely.
And the ego is constantly grasping onto something else or wanting something. You have to let it go. So maybe he just tricked us. the whole idea of this liberated being or enlightened being who has somehow reached a state and never has to work anymore.
Yeah.
Like I'm at a place, like it's a location or a place or a finished state. It's something that's always changing.
Yeah.
Even the enlightened one is always changing too, right?
Yeah.
Everything is always changing. So it has to be something that's a practice. And the Buddhism said it's an action.
Yeah. You got it.
An action religion. You have to practice it.
You have to practice
it. Christianity should be an action religion too. You should have to practice it.
So and it's sort of a... It is. Well, you know, he says
at
different times, he says, you know, like, whatever you aspire for with your whole heart, like, you'll get it eventually. So don't aim low.
Right.
You know, don't aim for a sort of half liberation. Like, aim high. And then the system sort of, you know, shelters that within the myth of enormous stretches of time. So it's like, yeah, aim high. And this was the Buddha's last birth after millions and millions of lifetimes of practice. So, like, don't worry about whether you're getting it tonight or 10 years from now or before you die. Like, use this life well. But
just keep going.
Just keep it. It's going to keep going. Like,
keep stepping. Totally.
But I don't think it's possible to recognize the desire for that without having it inherent without in you. I mean, how could you want that which you don't know at some level?
Yeah.
So it has to be there. There's something that resonates at the deepest level with this, so you're pulled. It's not, you can't perceive of it if it wasn't inherent within you.
Yeah. Yeah.
No?
This is the teaching that would really turn into like Dharma as your true nature, you know, Buddha as your true nature, not some other thing, but this thing that was already there. It's a beautiful reflection to wonder, like, what is it that would wake someone up to their life enough to make them even want to search? Like, something wakes up already that you even want to be free. What is that? What happened? You know? And so... So yeah, you know, it'll take 1,000 years for it to fully flower into, you know, tantric language. But eventually, that very insight will become, like, you know, inborn Buddha nature expressing itself as your suffering self, unfolding spontaneously with grace, for the pleasure of unfolding, and with no other thing happening other than. That reality is you know, vibrant and vibrating, and that's all that's happening. And you thought you were lost, but you know, check it out. So that it's going to go there for exactly the reasons that you're saying, because the
but you said
it's implied.
I didn't say that.
You know?
You said.
So thank you, friends. Really, it's a pleasure to be here with you on a beautiful holiday. Thank you for your offerings and your generosity in sustaining this group within the model of there being no fixed price. Your generosity sustains both the studio and myself to offer this in this way. And next week we'll go back to, you know, racism, sexism, the deep demons that we've been talking about lately, practicing with. So take care of yourselves till then.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you.